A warm welcome to our first parent show of 2023 here on Mix 92.6. We'd like to wish you all a happy and healthy new year. Tonight, we're looking at a recent survey by Sport England on kids' activity, or the apparent lack of it. And Neil Roger will speak to Chris Gregory from the LEAP organisation. But first, we're marking World Braille Day, which was on January the 4th, when Lydia caught up with Charlotte Meller and Luke Wakefield from Victa, a national charity whose aim is to support and empower visually impaired children and young adults, together with their parents, about their online and offline activities.
Hello and welcome to the Parents Show on Mix 92.6. And in case you didn't know, it's World Braille Day on January the 4th. And we just thought this is an excellent opportunity to bring in members of our local and wider community to talk to us about visually impaired parents and children. So I'm really, really pleased to have Charlotte Meller and Luke Wakefield from Victa who are joining us today. Luke, Charlotte, how are you both doing?
Yeah, very well. Thank you, Lydia.
So I mentioned Victa, but I haven't told our listeners about the fantastic work you do. Luke, can you tell us a little bit about what you do to support our visually impaired community?
Yeah, of course. So we're actually a national charity based in Milton Keynes, and we support visually impaired children and young adults from zero, from birth, all the way to the age of 29. Within that, we have separate age ranges. So we have our early years program, which is for 0 to 4 year olds. We've just launched just this month, just as a new year program, new year project, our Young Achievers Award, which is for 10 and under. And then sort of moving into our residential age groups and day trips, we have our 10 to 13 year olds, known as our preteens, our 14 to 17 year olds, known as our youth, and then our young adults, which are 18 to 29. And within those different age groups, we do a mixture of, like I say, residential activities up and down the country, at different activity centres, different venues. We do a summer camp for our teenagers in the summer. Pre-COVID, we also did international trips as well, as a chance, a little bit of semi-independent travel. We haven't done that for obvious reasons the last few years, but hoping to pick that up again. All around developing independence, confidence, social skills, self-esteem, as well as through the activities that our young people take part in, being able to develop key transferable career skills from a very young age. So whilst they're having fun on a climbing rope course at the age of 10, they don't realise that they're actually showing great communication skills or teamwork skills. And these are things that we then subsequently point out to them and their parents and say, actually, you've shown great examples of teamwork, great communication, great problem solving, and continue that as they go through all those different age groups. And as they do go through the age groups, like I say, at the age of 14, there's a chance to earn things like the Duke of Edinburgh's Award, John Muir Award, we deliver the Arts Awards. So as well as those skill development, there's also the chance to earn certifications. So lots of opportunities for fun and lots of opportunities to develop some really important skills for our young people.
That's unbelievable. Such a huge variety and dynamic selection of activities. It sounds like Victa's quite busy.
It's a very busy calendar. We're only a small team, so there's mostly just three of us as the activities team that go out and deliver these activities. So we're very rarely in the office 5 days a week, which is great. It means that we're meeting lots of people all the time, going off and doing these amazing things, working with some brilliant young people. It's a lot of fun.
Now, Luke, on that, tell us what your role is at Victa.
So I'm head of operations. Victa got a team of four, including Charlotte, where we go out and deliver activities, like I say, around the country. So my role is sort of developing that activities calendar, making sure that we try and hit as many different areas of the country as possible to access as many young people and their families as possible, making sure we deliver our big programs and projects such as the family weekends, where we have almost sort of 200 people on site twice a year at our family weekends, and just trying to find really fun, innovative programs, activities for our young people that perhaps you might not necessarily associate being possible for someone who has got a sight impairment. So, for example, one we always point to is our annual photography course that we do with our 18 to 29 year olds. You wouldn't think photography is something that someone with very little vision could do, but actually the results that we get from that course have been absolutely incredible. And we're looking to actually put together a gallery, an exhibition with the London Institute of Photography that we deliver the course with. Like I mentioned, we do Duke of Edinburgh. We've done things like surfing, all sorts of different activities that try and cover as many different passions and interests as possible.
Fantastic. And Charlotte, tell us about your role at Victa and tell us a little bit more about yourself.
So I found out about Victor because my daughter, who is now 12, was born with a visual impairment. When she was born, we didn't realise that she was blind, which is quite common for a lot of parents who have children that have been born with sight conditions. It tends to be around the 4-month mark that you can actually pick up that your child's not tracking and locking on to things in the sighted way. My daughter's condition is called optic nerve hyperplasia, and that's basically an underdevelopment of the optic nerve. So the optic nerve acts as like the wiring between the eye and the brain. So the eye processes the images and then the brain recreates it. And the optic nerve plays a very important part in that. Hyperplasia just means underdevelopment. So it varies from child to child, but Scarlett's not got as many as she should have, and they're a lot shorter. Scarlett's quite unique in the fact that she's got no useful vision as a result of that. There does tend to be more children with like a varying degree of sight, but Scarlett has no useful vision. And yeah, so that happened, and that was a big part of my life, really. And I was quite lost at the time as to, where I would go from here. She's got a brother who's 368 days younger than her, and I was pregnant with him when I found out that Scarlett was blind. And then I'd just split up with my partner as well, so I'd become a single parent. So visually impaired child, another one on the way, kind of doing it on my own, so to speak. And I'd use the
internet. A lot to juggle.
Yeah, definitely. A lot going on. And I found kind of a lot of support on the internet. In particular, there was one website which was American-based. So it was useful and helpful, but a lot of the information that was portrayed on there was with, the American way of life rather than what we'd, the hospitals we'd discuss over here or the educational institution we'd discuss over here. So I used that website quite frequently and went on YouTube and followed pages. As a result of that, I decided to set up something similar to the Wonder Baby website, just blogging about mine and my daughter's life and, why we were going to go from here and the processes that I went through to kind of accept that the child that I thought I was going to have is going to be very different than what I expected and, where we went from there. So I approached Victor to ask for a grant to set up this kind of parent support website, which was going to be UK-based. And it actually went really well because they wanted me to come on board as kind of like a parent support worker. So the website was set up, which was called Through Scarlett's Eyes at the time, and it was run as a sister website to the Victor organisation and give me lots of access to, being able to speak to the parents that I wanted to speak to and go to events and meet people. And so, as much as I was trying to use my experiences to help other parents, it was a really big, learning opportunity for me myself, because I was meeting kind of parents of visually impaired children and, fully engaged in this big community. So from there it grew, really. And it's so now it kind of looks a little bit different from a parent's blogging site. It's more of a parents information hub, but we've tried to maintain the blog side of the website so that we've got the human element there, which I find is really important. I think I read a lot of personal stories when my daughter was first diagnosed, and I kind of wanted to make sure that that was maintained in the website. And from that, we've developed a online support group, which is, I would say, I've not checked, I think it's probably at around 900 people now. So they're all parents of visually impaired people or professionals who work in the sector, and people can access that group to ask questions. And you can ask that question to 800 different people. I get some like real, horse's mouth feedback and advice. And it's a nice, busy, active group. We're very proud of it at Victor. It's got, a lot of integrity. It's not, an advertising place where people go to talk and meet other people. And that is like one of the big things I found as a parent that helped me early on, was finding these parents and connecting with them, because there was nobody else who could kind of put themselves in my shoes in terms of, what I was about to face with raising Scarlett. So yeah, that's me and what I do for Victor.
What a journey. My goodness, Charlotte, you're absolutely a role model for other parents. And I'm sure, well, obviously lots of parents are benefiting from the work you've done. That's absolutely fantastic. So give us a flavour of the kind of activities you do with Victor.
It's quite an exciting time of year to ask that question, really, as we're launching into the new sort of activities calendar. The pandemic forced us to combine sort of virtual activities alongside our traditional sort of in-person activities. And over the last couple of years, we feel like we've really honed that, and we've got a really nice blend across the year. I mean, starting from the 4th of January with World Braille Day, we'll be launching our annual World Braille Art Competition for everyone to enter, for all of our young people to enter, different categories that they can enter. And it's been running the last few years. We've developed a relationship with the CNIB, which is the Canadian National Institute for the Blind, where they are now going to be entering that competition as like an international category. So that's really exciting, launching on the 4th. Later this month, we will also be launching our virtual science fair, which we do in the lead up to British Science Week in March. We're also launching our Young Achievers Award this month. So a really busy month just in January alone. And then when we get to February and February half term, we've got some residentials for our teenagers to take part in, an arts award trip. Later in the year, we've got family weekends. So as I mentioned, we bring nearly 200 people together at Activity Centre up in Doncaster, and then one this year is going to be in North Wales. Families just coming together, taking part in all those fun activities that those activity centres have to offer, climbing rope, jumping into boats. But as well as that, parents get to access workshops delivered by ourselves and sort of third-party partners around topics that they tell us that they're interested in and want to find out more about. The family weekends, we also invite some of our young adults, our 18-plus young adults, who are confident to come and speak to parents and families about their experiences growing up with a vision impairment. And we find that tends to be the most valuable part of the weekend, certainly for parents, listening to 25-year-olds talking about their experiences growing up when they've got their 8-year-old in mind, thinking, my child could follow this path or follow that path, and just taking that bit of advice from those young adults. Also mentioned that we used to do internationals before COVID. Hopefully this year, fingers crossed, we might be taking a group of young adults to Florence in September, which would be lovely. There's a really, really varied calendar of in-person activities as well as virtual ones. So really exciting year coming up. Really looking forward to it.
It's certainly action-packed. Oh, I'm a bit jealous. I'd like to go with you. And Charlotte, I'd like to ask you and Luke, how do parents react to you guys and to the kind of provision of this kind of activities and the children? What are their reactions to this and how do they get involved?
Yeah, I think we've got, you know, a really strong community of parents. You know, the family weekends that Luke have just touched on, I think these people would just come every year until the children were 16 because they're that popular and they get so much out of that particular weekend. We get comments like, you know, my child never won't be separated from me and go and do that climbing activity. They're just not like that. And we pull them apart because we've been doing it for many years and we know that we've got some very qualified and good volunteers who have also been supporting VI children. And by the end of the weekend, the children have got their own little group of buddies and they're around visually impaired children and they've got their own kind of little group there, which isn't what it starts like at the beginning. So it just shows how they grow in confidence. I suppose it must be quite nice not to feel completely different to everyone else, you know, around you, and they're in a safe space and with other children who understand what it's like to be visually impaired. So there's that empathy there. So it's a really beautiful thing to see, actually. I always get really emotional at these weekends. And as Luke said, we've got our virtual program now. When we couldn't really support parents during the pandemic, we grew this online. Everyone went online and everyone was doing Zoom courses. And we kind of jumped onto that in terms of helping our parents. And we do a big program now. We probably do about 6 or 7 workshops a year. And they're always oversubscribed. And we get lots of feedback from the parents about, you know, what they want to learn about, what topics they want covering. And we invite our young people to come in and deliver on them sessions as well. And these parents can ask these. I think the most recent workshop I had was somebody who works in Apple, but was also doing a PhD and had literally no vision and living independently. And all these parents who are trying to envision what their children's future are like could speak to these people, these, you know, really remarkable young people who are, you know, making big changes in the world. So I think the parents' response to the online workshops have been really good. And we collaborate with other organisations. We find that there's a lot of power with working with other people. We, you know, if we can do something better together, then we've definitely got that ethos as an organisation.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I absolutely concur with everything that Charlotte's just said. She's put together an amazing programme of virtual parent workshops, which, like she says, always oversubscribed. And actually, the construct that Charlotte's put together for those workshops, where we bring in the expert 1 week and the following week, Charlotte does a sort of very informal follow-up with those parents just to discuss everything that came up in that first workshop. And we found it as a model that worked really, really well. Our parents love that opportunity to, first of all, listen to the expert, and then in the following week, be able to share their own experiences. It works so well. The virtual nature of it means we're bringing families together from all over the country and connecting these families together where they might not necessarily be doing that. So it's been a really successful part of our virtual activity, are the parent workshops. It's been amazing.
Brilliant. Oh, they sound fantastic. And I wonder, I mean, as parents, we're always winging it a bit, aren't we? We're always, you know, you think you've got one thing nailed and then the next phase comes and you're starting from scratch again. And it must be even more challenging if you're, as a parent, not visually impaired and your child is. It must add even more challenge to it. How does their development and their growth, how do you stay on top of that, Charlotte?
I think, you know, a big issue, and, you know, it's not a secret that children's mental health services are, you know, at a scale to cater to everyone's needs at the moment. I think, you know, waiting lists for CAMHS or getting referrals or seeing counsellors and things like that are always very difficult things to access through the NHS at the moment because they're so stretched. And I think we've identified that as a charity and are trying to put things in place so that, you know, we might not be able to get them a counselling session, but we can signpost them to another organisation that offers counselling, or we can run one of our workshops so that that, you know, empowers the parents to be able to pick up on certain things and, you know, certain parenting styles that might be beneficial to deal with, you know, if your child's in distress, if your child is feeling isolated. So we know there's a real need for this mental health support. And although we're not mental health professionals, we are trying to bring those to the table and offer them to the parents so that they're getting that support to help them with the development and growth. It's difficult. You do think things go quite smoothly for a while and then something else pops up which causes another issue. A lot of children, when they go into mainstream high school, is when a lot of issues start to arise because the school is a lot bigger, the workload's a lot higher. It's things like adapting, you know, we can change an English document into Braille so that the child can access it. But things like science and, you know, other topics aren't always as easy to make accessible. And then there's the social side of it because they all start going out independent with the friends. And it's, you know, is your a child confident enough on the road? Are they able to keep themselves safe enough to do that? So that does tend to be, you know, where some issues do arise. And we're just trying to overcome them or give the parents opportunities to overcome them, if that makes sense.
It does indeed, absolutely. So you mentioned us science, and actually that was something I wanted to ask you about. Talk to us about a British Science Week and what you're up to, Victor.
That came about 2 or 3 years ago, right in the sort of the depths of lockdown, where we couldn't leave our houses and we were looking for a way to connect with our young people, still take part in activities and do things just from home. Science is one of those areas that we hadn't delivered too much on, but we knew was of interest to our young people. STEM, everything to do with technology, was really important to our young people. So we developed a virtual science fair where everyone could take part. So for the early years age groups, we had access to Lego Braille sets, which were amazing at sort of doing those very early basic sort of engineering tasks, I suppose, with Lego. For slightly older children, we had tasks and challenges they could do at home that were very easily resourced, very cheaply resourced as well. They could do those at home. Parents could take photos and videos and share them with us, and they could enter them into a competition for prizes. For our slightly older sort of teenagers, anyone familiar with the TV show Taskmaster, we took a lot of inspiration from the sort of the elements of that show and created sort of tasks for our young people to take part in, and again take photos and videos of them doing those at home and entering them into competitions for prizes. But a big part of the science fair was for our young adults with the careers section, and we've recorded a lot of Zoom interviews with a lot of STEM professionals. Some are visually impaired, some weren't. That wasn't necessarily the criteria. It was to show the breadth and depth of different types of careers available in the STEM world that actually are totally accessible for visually impaired young people to take part in. We spoke to a visually impaired astronomer, a visually impaired oceanographer. We spoke to a VI student in the fourth year of her medical degree. It was phenomenal, the range of interviews that we got, and we're continually adding to them every year, as well as now that we can go outside and do things in person, as well as in-person activities as well. So it's grown and grown, and it's caught the attention of the British Science Association. We wrote a blog for their website about what we do. We've been invited to be part of their community leader program and their subsequent community buddy program. So we work quite closely with them on the development of the of the virtual science fair, and it's just grown from strength to strength. And every year now we include more and more of our young people in the development of the science fair website. It's really important to us to include our young people in the development of all of our activities, but certainly those virtual activities where what their input in terms of different tasks, different challenges, just reviewing it and telling us, actually, is it accessible? What can we do to improve it? So it's been, it's just grown year on year. It's been a real big success for us.
Fantastic. And so I'm sure if any parents are listening in and they have a child who is visually impaired, they're desperate to know, can they reach out? Can they get in touch with you? Are there any barriers to entry?
In terms of barriers to entry, we do ask for proof of vision impairment, and we can talk through parents what that looks like. But I would say get in touch with us through all those usual ways. We have our website. Charlotte runs that parent network Facebook group. We're on all the social media channels. So get in touch with us any which way possible. And because we're quite a small dynamic team, you will be put in touch with the right person quite quickly. And we'll be able to talk to you over the phone, over email, however is easiest, whichever is most comfortable for you, and try and find the right thing that suits you and your child.
And before we let you go, any tips for parents who are listening in, Charlotte, from your experience about looking for help and looking for support?
Engaging with charities and finding other parents. When I went to my first VI specific stay and play when my daughter was 18 months old, that completely changed everything from that point. I had met people who I could have conversations with, who knew what was going on, charities who could support it. A big turning point for me was I was trying to see if I could get Scarlett's sight impairment fixed. And it was only on reflection, like a couple of years later, I thought, oh, I'm just telling her that she's broken, and she's not broken. She was born how she was supposed to be born. And once you feel that as a parent, then life will get much easier and the road won't be as bumpy. But yeah, that's the one that I always do. Oh, and don't wrap them up in cotton wool. Let them bang their heads occasionally. They need to learn how to do that. But yeah, they're the ones that I open my go-tos whenever I do this type of stuff.
Brilliant. Thanks, Charlotte. And listen, how's Scarlett doing?
Oh, she's great. She's great. She's got a learning disability and autistic as well. So she goes to a complex needs school. What's quite special about Scarlett is she's not got the level of understanding to know that she's blind. So she doesn't have any of that kind of mental health issues in relation to having to address what her life is. So, she just sings all day, sings and eats all day. Oh. I'm very glad she's not here for this interview because we're trying to kick her out of the room.
With all this singing in the background.
Yeah, that is it.
Oh, brilliant. She sounds fantastic. And the work you're doing sounds absolutely amazing. Thank you. And thanks for coming on the Parents Show.
Real pleasure. Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for inviting us, Lydia. Much appreciated.
Hello, this is the Parents Show on Hertfordshire's Mix 92.6 FM. I'm Neil Roger. Last week, Sport England released the latest data on childhood activity. I'm here with Chris Gregory, who's going to be talking to us about that and about the importance of kids staying active. Chris, thanks for joining us. Do you want to introduce yourself a bit?
Yeah, sure. Hi, Neil. So I'm Chris Gregory. I'm Head of Strategic Relationships at LEAP. LEAP's an active partnership, so we're funded by Sport England to operate at a local level. I also wear a hat as the local chair of Harpen and Colts Football Club. And I'm also a dad to three boys aged 7 to 9.
Well, in that case, double thanks for joining us. You do sound like a very, very busy man. So, Chris, this report last week, what does it tell us? What sort of data have they come up with from Sport England?
Yeah, so the Active Lives survey is released annually. And this set of data is from last academic year. So 21-22 school year, it's surveying 5 to 16-year-olds. And it basically starts, it tells us the activity levels of the children and young people, both in school and outside of school. So it asks them questions about how much sport they play, how much walking and cycling they do and scooting and all that type of thing. And it gives Sport England a really good indicator, and many of our local organisations that work with young people about where we are and how affected young people are by things like COVID restrictions, cost of living crisis, that type of stuff. So where we are currently with the data that was released from last year is that 47% of children aged 5 to 16 are meeting the guidelines of activity levels each day. Now, for parents out there, that's 60 minutes a day. You need to be looking for your child to be moving and active. And that's not 60 minutes of football or sport specifically. That is 50 minutes of getting their heart rate above resting and activating muscles and moving around generally. So it can be anything. It doesn't have to be structured activity. So in England, it's 47%. In Hertfordshire, it's about 47.7%. So just above national average, which as a resident of Hertfordshire myself, I'm a bit disappointed by that, to be honest, because Hertfordshire is usually above the national average and it's only just above the national average. So I think we need to do a bit more as parents and as people who sort of work in the area and try and encourage kids to be active. So we've got 47% of young people who are reaching 60 minutes. That means over half of the young people are not reaching that guideline, which is a concern. And then in terms of youngsters doing less than 30 minutes, which is what they also measure a day, in nationally, it's 30% of young people are doing less than 30 minutes of activity a day. And in Hertfordshire, that's 28.8% of young people. So slightly better than the national average again for Hertfordshire on that, which is what I'd expect. So yeah, we're in that stage. And I think what parents need to think about is that 60 minutes, as I said, can be made up from a whole host of activity. And it's generally about raising the levels of the heart rate and activating muscles. And parents probably need to be thinking, I need to take responsibility for about 30 minutes of that a day, especially if they're at school and nursery. And then the school and nursery should take care of the other 30 minutes of that. So that's the sort of rule of thumb you should be looking at. But yeah, so that's the data. So nationally, just under half of young people, which is not particularly good. And then in Hearts, about the same. But we've still got 30% who are doing less than 30 minutes of activity. So that is a bit of a concern.
It's actually 30% is actually a staggering amount, isn't it? Considering it seems such a small amount of time. I mean, I guess most of us kind of know some of the answer to this, Chris, but why is it really important for kids to be active?
Yeah, so obviously you form habits for life in your childhood, and it's a real time when you're growing, developing your skills, your mental health, your physical health. So the habits you form when you're a child do carry on into adulthood. And so it's a really important thing that we find young people something they enjoy to do that gets them moving. And for some, that will be really, they'll love their sport and they'll love their team sports, or they'll be more of an individual sport person. For some, sport will not be the thing that interests them at all. And it'll be walking, maybe scooting, cycling, going to the park, skateboarding, whatever. But it's really important that we start to, that children and young people have a positive relationship with movement and activity and understand what it feels like to the heart rate to go above resting, that it's okay to be out of breath, that actually it's a really positive thing. You know, the endorphins that are released when you stop being active are a really powerful, natural, mental health and stimulators. So really important. I think for children and young people, there's some key things. Being regularly active, so meeting that 60 minutes of activity a day, builds muscle and bone strength, which is really important. It improves general health and fitness, builds confidence and social skills, because quite often when you're being active, particularly in a club or a structured like playgroup type environment, you're interacting with people, you're learning to win and lose, you're learning to share, you're learning teamwork. It develops coordination. And as a dad of young boys, that was really important to me, that they had good eye-hand coordination, that they could throw and catch, that they could kick a ball. And actually those things connect back into the classroom and into the world of work. So if you're coordinated and confident in that thing, it connects to your micro and your macro development. So your ability to write and concentrate. And you'll see a lot of schools and nurseries now using like wake and shake type activities or daily miles, where they'll try and get them to be ready to learn. Or they'll take a break from learning by being active and getting them moving. And that's particularly important for boys. I know that's slightly stereotypical, but concentration levels often of boys is slightly shorter than girls. So actually breaking it up with some activity that refreshes their mind and gets them ready to learn again is really important. As well as it helps improve sleep, which we all know as parents, if your child sleeps, that is number one on the tick box. You can deal with most things if you can get a good sleep. So tiring them out so they sleep well is a really important thing. It maintains a healthy weight. It's not the primary thing around weight. Diet is for weight, but it definitely helps young people maintain a healthy weight if their diet is good. And then just generally makes you feel good. You know, as we both know, when you're active and you're outdoors and you're going for a run or a walk or playing football, those endorphins that are released are so important. So there are multiple benefits. I would argue, and a lot of experts, health experts do, that it is probably the best single public health investment you can make in your future health. And as I said, if we can make young people get that, build that into their day and their lifestyle right from an early age and have a positive influence and relationship with activity, then that carries into adulthood. And that is so, so important as we get older around both our physical and our mental health.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And I guess some of it is probably around what kids see at home and copy and learn off their parents as well. So what sort of stuff can parents do to get their kids more active? Because it's really interesting what you said, Chris, about it's not necessarily about sport, although it obviously can be. It's about activity as well. So what can parents be doing to help their kids to get and stay more active?
Yeah, and parents play a big role in this. Obviously, there's lots of people that influence young people as they grow up, but parents are the primary peer, primary mentor, the primary person that they see every day. And even the things we think they don't see us do, they see it and they pick up on it, even subconsciously. So you can help your child be active by generally being active yourself. That is probably number one. And actually, that will benefit your own physical and your emotional well-being if you can stay active yourself and find some time for yourself to be active. You know, don't feel guilty about that. That is important time for you as a parent to have time to yourself or time to connect with other people and look after your own health and invest in your physical and mental health. So that's really important that as a parent, you recognize that and you make time for it. And the your children will recognize that. They'll see you put your trainers on and they'll see you go out for a run or a walk or go to do your five-a-side football on an afternoon or go to your Pilates class. They will recognize that. You might not think they do, and they think that's normal. And then when they think that's normal, that's what they aspire to do when they're your age. So for number one is parental influence is critical. But the other things you can do is just generally, you know, walking or scooting or cycling are just really good things as a family that you can do together. And all ages, I mean, you know, scooting, balance bikes, cycling once they're old enough to cycle, really important things. Don't always reach for the keys of the car to go on a journey. Can you do the journey on foot? Can you do the journey to the park on a bike or a scooter? And actually, if you're thinking about that 60 minutes a day, you're going to need to do some of that because you can't structure a club and a PE lesson every day of the week. You're going to need to find some time where it's just part of you moving around in the day. So really important. And I know the weather and the light's a nightmare in this country, but genuinely, if you're dressed well, then you can get outdoors and move a little bit. And walking is probably one of the best ways to do that. So I certainly think it's parents thinking about, I don't have to structure this activity. I can walk them to the park and they can burn off some energy in the park, or I can scoot them to school and back, and not thinking that it has to be an after school club all the time. I actually think as parents, we overstructure our kids' lives a little bit.
And actually, I agree with that.
If you put them in clubs too much, they don't know how to entertain themselves or find their own way of moving and developing their own sort of play and ability to play with themselves or with other people. So yeah, it doesn't have to be structured and it doesn't have to cost money. It genuinely doesn't. Some of that activity in the week is good for them to be structured and be with other young people and learn to win and lose and share and be a good teammate and things. But it doesn't have to be the bulk of it. Actually going to the park or walking to school or walking to the shops or going to the park is as valuable as that structured activity.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And you've kind of covered this a bit, Chris, but one of the things that you mentioned was parents and stuff. Now, the kind of push to people to get active is maybe a relatively recent thing. So there are obviously parents who are from the era where, like, you're either sporty or you're not, you do it or you don't. So, you know, what would you say to those parents who aren't necessarily so active themselves, but who aren't quite sure how to get their kids more active?
So, yeah, there's probably many of us in our general who had bad experiences in PE or at a sports club locally. And that's really clouded our perspective of what sport and activity is. The good news is that actually there's a whole host of activity out there, and I've touched on some of it. It doesn't have to be a class, an exercise class. It doesn't have to be at a leisure centre. It doesn't have to be at a sports club. But there is a whole host of activity out there that is, and there is something there for everyone. And as simple as walking and talking often is a good activity. So I think for adults and children, it's about finding something you enjoy, because the challenge is when it gets cold, wet and dark, if you don't enjoy that activity, you're not going to go out of the house and put the trainers on to go and do it. So first and foremost, you've got to find something you enjoy. I quite like to be, some people like to be active on their own or with other people. I think it's really important that you work out whether that's what you like, whether you like to be active and do an activity on your own, or, and you don't want anyone to see you doing that activity, then there's a lot of free online content that can be found on YouTube or on Sport England's website. It's got a great activity program that's all online, and you can do the class in the comfort of your own lounge. But if you like being active and doing activity with other people, then I think, you know, whether it's a walk, can you find a buddy? Can you find a friend to go out for a walk with you? Or whether it's, you know, five-a-side football or back to netball activities. Mostly local councils will have lists of activity providers out there. And if you, you know, you go on Google and you search, you'll find activity. And it's about trying lots of activity. And certainly I think taking it back to young people, particularly in those early years, primary school age, and nursery age, it's about letting them try and experience lots of different activities and lots of different ways to find them that they move. And not all of them will enjoy it. You'll sign them up for the local football club, like mine, like Harpenden Colts. And we get plenty of youngsters that it's just not for them. And actually, after half a term or a term or a year or a couple of years, they decide that football's not their thing. And actually, they move on to something else. And that's absolutely fine. And I think we need to not push kids into a particular activity and sport because that's what we enjoyed. It's about giving them that range of activity. And it's no different to an adult. Finding something you enjoy and finding people you like to be active with is really important. And then one final thing is the way I try and think about activity is on the days when I'm going to go and be active, I find that I need to do my activity early in the day, because the longer the day goes on, I find reasons not to do it. Like, what, life's busy. You've got work, you've got kids, you're juggling stuff. So I need to do my act. I need to get up. I need to be dressed in the kit that I'm going to go and do the activity, and I need to go and do it. Because if I don't be active before breakfast or get out of the house and do it, then I'll find any reason, especially in the winter, not to do it. So you need to work out for yourself, when's your time to go and be active and when does it work best for you? And then try and make a habit and a routine out of it, because otherwise life's busy and you'll find any reason not to do it.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. So I feel like the most important thing is parents need to get the kids doing that 6 minutes activity a day, but it doesn't have to be a high-pressured class or a structured thing. Even just walking to the park with them, letting them play, is a real kind of win on that score.
Yeah, absolutely. Play is such an important part of that 60 minutes. You know, if you think about the 30 minutes that the school are going to take responsibility for, that'll be lunchtimes, playground. That'll be before school, after school in the playground. And you'll get a lot of activity going and the heart rate above resting during those periods. So play is so important. You know, if we overstructure everything and put them in clubs all the time, they'll never know how to play for themselves. And, you know, everyone knows as a parent, that's quite frustrating when they can't play on their own for a little bit and constantly want you to be the play thing that they call a play partner. You need to try and develop independent kids that actually give you a break every now and again.
Yeah, completely agree, for everybody's sake.
Yeah.
Well, look, Chris, thank you so much. That's been really helpful. I guess one last question, Ad. You're an expert on all things sport and activity. So I'm in my mid-40s now. What sport do you think I should take up now if I want the best chance of turning professional before I'm 50?
Oh, okay. Best chance. So you need to pick a minority sport. You need
pole vault.
You need to pick one that not a lot of people play in and take part in. So what should I go for? I reckon, I mean, to be honest, everyone in our sort of age group would be, they're cyclists now, aren't they? They get on these ridiculously overpriced bikes and go out. But I think it's just to get out of the house, to be honest. but so maybe cycling's one of them, but I think that's a bit obvious. How about ultimate frisbee? Have you ever tried Ultimate Frisbee?
I haven't, but done. All right, Ultimate Frisbee, that's the plan. I'll be probably in the Olympics by the next 5 or 6 years if I start tomorrow. So
that sounds good.
All right, Chris, look, thank you so much. That was really interesting. And I think that's hopefully given a lot of good advice for parents out there who get a bit confused by this sort of stuff. So, look, thank you so much for joining us, Chris. Really appreciate it.
No problem.
Hello and welcome to the Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Lydia El-Khoury.
And I'm Neil Roger.
So on tonight's show, we're going to deal with a sensitive topic and one that might be disturbing to some parents. But as always on the Parents Show, we feel we need to bring you all the information that's out there so you can make the best decisions possible and bring the best people to you to talk about all sorts of issues that relate to parenting. So on tonight's show, we've got Claire Howard, who is a family lawyer with Raiden Solicitors, and we're going to talk about the removal of parental responsibility. Claire, thanks a million for joining us on the Parents Show this evening.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, I think we might all have an idea of what this is, but can you describe what exactly parental responsibility is for us, please, Claire?
Yes, I think understanding the concept of parental responsibility before any discussion surrounding whether it can be removed is important. Parental responsibility effectively allows the parents the ability to make decisions for their children. So on the most part, it's your day-to-day decisions, bedtimes, clothes, food, activities. Larger decisions, such as medical decisions, education, religion, should be made equally between both parents with the parental responsibility. It will always be ongoing during the children's minority. So it's not the case where there's often a misconception that it switches between handovers for separated parents. Both parents will always maintain it. It's also not the case that one parent's parental responsibility is more important than the other. It's automatically equal. So in utilising the parental responsibility, it's sensible that both parents allow the other parent to parent and make day-to-day decisions. It's usually the bigger decisions that can sometimes create more of a problem.
Thanks, Claire. How is parental responsibility acquired? How does one parent obtain it, or how is it divided out? How does that side of it work?
A birth mother has automatic parental responsibility. A married father, so if the father is married to the mother who gave birth, they will also have automatic parental responsibility for that child. If the parents aren't married and the child is born after the 1st of December 2003 and he's named on the birth certificate, then that's also automatic parental responsibility. I won't go into too much detail today, but there are other methods of acquiring it. So a father perhaps who isn't named on the birth certificate could make an application either by agreement or with the mother or through court. A step parent could enter into a step parent parental responsibility agreement with consent of both parties, or sometimes a party with who the child or children lives with could also make an application to court for parental responsibility. But generally speaking, the most common ways of acquiring it are birth by the mother, marriage for the father, or being named on the birth certificate for the father.
Can I bring you back a little bit, Claire? You said about decisions, the big decisions. So can you kind of give us a few concrete examples of what would constitute a big decision? What's something that you really don't need to kind of, you know, have a joint decision over?
So in a scenario perhaps where the parents are separated, a day-to-day decision would be what the child may have for breakfast. It could be what clothes they're going to wear that day. A larger decision would be which school the child attends. It could be deciding on which religion they may operate under. It could be that if a serious medical decision needed to be made, say an operation, that those larger decisions should be made between both parties. It can also be if one parent is wanting to change the child's name, that would also need both parties' consent.
Okay, that gives us a great idea of what it means in concrete terms, because I'm sure it's very easy to get stuck in the mud there a little bit about what constitutes a big decision and what not. So now let's get down to the nuts and bolts of it. Why might a parent seek to remove parental responsibility from the other parent?
I think there's three common reasons why parties might seek to remove parental responsibility. The first is that in some occasions, the party paying child maintenance may wish to avoid doing so, or that party is not involved in the child's life. If it's the case in a scenario, perhaps where it's the father, that paternity is called into question, then that's a different issue. If it's the case that that parent is biologically linked to the child, then parental responsibility cannot be removed by agreement unless in adoption proceedings. The second reason why parties may wish to remove parental responsibility is that they have separated and they no longer wish to rely upon the other party's consent for bigger decisions, particularly if they've got a parent who's uncooperative with them. Parental responsibility ensures that both parents have input into the children's lives, so it can never be a matter of removing parental responsibility for convenience. The court will always prioritise an agreement or an arrangement in which both parties are involved with the children, provided it's safe to do so. The court's primary position is that the welfare of the child or children is paramount, and therefore it can be a balancing act in some cases as to whether involving the parent is more or less likely to be in that child's interest. The third reason is for serious safeguarding of the parent and or child or children. In those circumstances, the removal of parental responsibility is incredibly rare and difficult, and it's only been achieved in a handful of cases. The theme in those cases is that the behaviour of the parent for whom parental responsibility may be being removed is that it has to be extreme and life-threatening. And in those circumstances, it requires a removal of parental responsibility to protect the child and the family from serious emotional and physical harm. If there's no such history of that level to the case, then it's very unlikely that parental responsibility could be removed.
Thanks, Claire. That's really interesting. So when you talk about parental responsibility being removed, the reasons for it make loads of sense. How does that actually happen? What is that process? And then also, how is that enforced afterwards?
So the only case law that currently exists in relating to removing parental responsibility exists for removing it from fathers. In that scenario, if an application were raised to the court for removing a father's parental responsibility, and working on the assumption in this scenario that the behaviour is extreme enough to warrant it, parental responsibility can be removed from the father if it was acquired by virtue of being named on the birth certificate. If parental responsibility was acquired by virtue of marriage to the mother, it cannot be removed. The case law is there that it can only be removed on account of being named on the birth certificate. There's no case law at the moment for removing parental responsibility for the mother, but my view is that where parental responsibility is acquired for mothers on birth, my suspicions are that it would also follow that it can't be removed. However, in the event that the behaviour warranted the removal of parental responsibility, but either parent acquired it through birth or through marriage, then what the court does have the power to do is make what's called a prohibited steps order in Children Act proceedings to limit that parent's use of parental responsibility and rendering it virtually unusable. So whilst the terminology is different, the day-to-day usage of the parental responsibility would be broadly similar. It would therefore be sensible, I think, without going into mechanics in too much detail, to consider how parental responsibility was acquired, and before making an application to remove parental responsibility, consider whether that's the appropriate application or a prohibited steps order application, or potentially both, so the court's got the power to go down whichever route is appropriate at that stage.
So it sounds like very serious situations would have to be involved for parental responsibility to be removed, really. It's not something to be taken lightly. Mm-hmm. And Claire, can you help us understand? So was I right in understanding that birth mothers very rarely have parental responsibility removed?
There's no reported cases of that scenario where a mother's parental responsibility is removed on behaviour. It's not to say that there are cases which have happened which haven't been reported. And as before, it could be in adoption proceedings that parental responsibility can be removed. But in terms of a father scenario seeking parental responsibility to be removed from the mother, there's no reported case law. And so my suspicions would be in that sort of application, it would likely be a application for a prohibited steps order to limit the use of parental responsibility.
Claire, right. So being an optimist, you know, people change, circumstances change sometimes. So if someone had had their parental responsibility removed, can it be reinstated under any circumstances? You know, is there ways that things can be reviewed and people can get that back?
Once it's removed, there is potentially provision to apply for a parental responsibility order. So where we discussed earlier that it is a way of acquiring parental responsibility, it could be the case that one parent could raise an application to effectively ask for it back. There would have to be an extreme change in circumstances, and I think it would highly depend on the level of behaviour. If we're talking about the level of behaviour that warrants removing it of that seriousness, it's unlikely that it would succeed, but the application could exist. there's also, with those sort of applications, normally what's called a barring order attached, which limits the parent with whom the parental responsibility has been removed from bringing fresh applications to court without the court's permission. But it could be that if they had a persuasive application, that permission could be granted. It's also possible that if such order was made, that there could be leave to appeal. That would be time barred, and again, entirely dependent on the case. But there are potentially applications that could be made, depending on whether the behaviour has or is able to be remedied.
And Claire, so I'm trying to imagine situations. So if a parent is listening to this, and there is either, and their estranged partner or former partner, ex husband or wife are listening, and there is behaviour that they're really concerned about, how do they know if it kind of passes the threshold into removal of parental responsibility? Because it sounds like such a serious thing to do. And it also sounds like it's a little bit finite. It sounds like it's hard to remove. So not something to be taken lightly by anybody. What red flags should they be looking for? And what steps should they take if they see red flags?
I would say where there's only been a handful of cases at the moment that have been reported, there is no set bar of behaviour. And the level of abuse is always an entirely subjective matter and case dependent. So if there's a parent who feels that their case could be appropriate for either removal of parental responsibility or even prohibited steps order, depending on the facts of the case, then the sensible thing to do would be to take legal advice on the merits of whether or not there could be success in such application. What I don't want to do today is dismiss or discourage any parent that feel this might be a relevant application, because ultimately abuse takes many different forms. And again, it's entirely subjective. So I would say it would be sensible, if the red flags are starting to be raised, to take legal advice as to the appropriate method and route for their particular case.
So if your instinct is telling you that you feel that there's a case for any kind of abuse, get legal advice first.
Absolutely.
And foremost.
Yeah.
You've given us some real gems, Claire, and thank you very much for that. So, Claire, thanks a million for joining us on the Parents Show this evening. It's been really, really valuable for our listeners to get your advice and hear for your expertise.
Thank you. It's been lovely talking to you both.
Thanks very much, Claire.